you to another episode of Fed Ninjas. We are tickled, if tickled is the best word to describe this. Dr. Xinming Liu. Dr. Liu is a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Boise State University. He's also the director of cyber operations and the resilience program. He also holds a joint appointment with the Idaho National Laboratory and focuses or has interest in cyber operations and resilience curriculum development, which we'll get into in a bit, as well as industry controlled data resilience research. Now, there's a lot of things on resilience, and I love that word simply because in the times we are right now, it's a very important topic. Dr. Liu, thank you for being willing to spend some time with us.
All right. Thank you, Maurice. And thank you, Eric. Wasn't your kid in the program too? I forgot.
He was. So thank you, Dr. Liu. And I feel on our podcast, it's like Wayne's World. We're not worthy. We're not worthy to have you on our podcast.
No.
So thank you for joining. Dr. Liu created the curriculum for the cybersecurity program, which is amazing. Awesome instructors, professors at the program. Thank you for that. Amazing curriculum.
That's great to hear. When I look at what I do, we got to give them two things, the education and skill sets for them to go to workforce. Sometimes kids these days, all they want is tell me what to do. I say, I don't want to tell you what to do. It's going to take me a little longer or take us a little longer to get you to get you that education, meaning that you're going to struggle too, you're going to be frustrated. The truth is,
you've
never been frustrated in the education process. It means that you actually didn't learn because it didn't push the boundary of where you were.
Can I ask a question on this one? I was also an educator in the past, not formally, but from a training development role. Yep. And sometimes what would happen is you'd get a student that was fresh from the theoretical side of it. Yep. And then you put them in a hands-on experience. Oh my goodness, this is so different. So the question is, how do you integrate that hands-on experience with the theoretical knowledge that they learned at school? And it sounds like you're doing that in some ways right now.
Yes, we do. We try. But the thing is, there's no such thing as a perfect program. You continue need to make adjustments. Sometimes I don't have the bandwidth. I don't want to make an adjustment. I got to hire somebody new, somebody to come in behind me to clean up after what I do. Sometimes to being the person that starts something new does not mean that you are the best person to continue to maintain it. And I'm already there. So the way that we do it is labs and writing assignment, and which AI is creating a lot of trouble for higher ed. So the way we do labs is, how much trouble are you willing to go through yourself? If you have a big class, for example, we have tried this in one or two classes where we get students to build their own virtual environment before they do the lab. For some students, they're still willing to do that. And some, they struggle with the most basic thing, that because being an online program, you're really having trouble to get them to where they need to go.
Right.
So we end up assessing a lot of the labs that CompTIA put together. Or there's another company, there's a really small company called NDG that we use quite a bit too. Is because I believe 20 years ago, I probably wouldn't believe in this, but right now I do. Is if I buy a voucher and let somebody make a little money and let them handle my labs, I'm okay with that. I outsource it. I don't have to hire an extra guy to maintain all that. So that works. But we're talking about more technical hands-on skill sets building. For example, you teach them what is offensive security, defensive security, and forensic, but you got to give them some labs to play with. So those are all hands-on. But on the other spectrum, right now we're talking about risk assessment and risk management. You're going to give them a scenario for them to write a report. The thing is, there are still people out there thinking that they can get to cybersecurity with certification. I think there are a few students that's possible to do that. In most cases, you can, is because you really need to have that learning experience. For example, how to write a report, look at scenario, and having somebody guide you to that. That's just two examples. You're just trying to get them there, and some will come along with you. Some, they just wanted to take the shortcut, and some, that 10%, usually eat up a lot of your time and create a lot of your stress.
Dr. Liu, what you said about the labs too, very applicable labs. I observed my son going through these and he would ask me questions. He'd be like, how do we run Wireshark? How do we run Burp Suite to be able to do man-in-the-middle attacks like an attacker would do? Yep. How do we defend against these things? Like you said, report writing. really making them think and be able to prove that they can do this. But also what was really cool was real world scenarios, working with small companies mm-hmm. as their capstone to be able to solve problems, be able to be almost like a consultant company with their team
yep.
and be able to help build a project and be able to assist a real company. And that gives them that real world experience to where they're understanding how the workforce uses cybersecurity and IT principles and what is going to be expected from them. Thank you for that, because everything that I saw my son doing, I thought, wow, this is great. This allows them to hit the ground running when they get to the workforce.
Yeah. But so we got a lot of students, they just eat it up. But we got some that usually is like 5, 10%. All they want to do is complain about why is this applicable when they haven't even go find out. There are a lot that really eat it up and learning the fundamental to get them to the next stage, next progression. But most students are really good and really impressed, really respectable, and really sit down and learn the material. Lately, this last 12 to 18 months, with the launch of ChatGPT, really create a bunch of problems.
That brings a question. We interviewed Jason Meese, the CIO of Clutch Solutions, and he says that AI is making it so rapid that what was right one time is completely different on another occasion, something to that effect. And with that, what are some emerging trends or challenges that a cybersecurity curriculum should address?
I think one of the biggest challenge right now, I think, is not just a cybersecurity program, is the whole higher ed. Is student using the tools incorrectly? I think the later, in the old day, no, in the real world, we joke about if you got a hammer, everything looks like a nail. You probably shouldn't be hitting that. And then comes along, there's a calculator, and people think that you should never use a calculator because you're not going to know how to do math, which is not true. But then AI come along, in a way, is a tool. But ultimately, if your brain is in some way is the greatest AI, a basic learning machine learning tools that you got, but you got to feed those neurons with information. Otherwise, it doesn't know how to come up with a proper answer, meaning that you got to learn. So if all a student do is just use AI and put a prompt in and come up with an answer and just submit that, in some cases, most cases, we're probably going to catch it, and then tell student, hey, probably going to give you another opportunity to clean this up. You shouldn't be doing that. But in some, they spend so much time trying to avoid the AI detector or even a human read it, you know that no human being will write it that way, right? I don't want to be in a prosecution mode, or I don't want our instructor to spend so much time in prosecuting the usage of AI, but we do need to put some work into it, because ultimately, if we don't stress this to students, hey, you got to be careful with that. If you keep using that, you're not learning. If you're not learning and you know how quickly you can be replaced by a tool, I don't care whether we call it AI or what, but it's really not an AI. It's actually a machine learning model and using some data from some way. It could be garbage in or garbage out, which is what students don't get. Because ultimately, you think about little kids, they're exposed to their environment. They're exposed to everything that we put in front of them or somebody put around them, and they just soak it up and learning. That's how you train their brain. If they don't serious about their learning, you got to be careful. You can get the job, but the question is, are you capable of staying in it?
Yeah, that's awesome. Dr. Liu, that is a perfect analogy of it. And really what you put into it is what you're going to get out of it. So you just expect the easiest path. I think that's a problem that people see is AI. Wow. Tell it to with a prompt, write a paper and make it look like this. And it comes out with it. So they see that easiest path. Wow. I don't have to do anything. Yeah. When in reality, we bring up the term hallucinations. I can identify with that. I probably hallucinate 10 times a day. So I assume everything is going to be wrong from it. And what I've told my kids, I'm like, okay, here's AI. Here's how to use it properly, how I think at this point, could be wrong. But what I've also introduced them to is just using the voice narrator in Microsoft Word or whatever Word document editor you want to use. Mm. And just say, okay, what are the things that you're looking at the requirement for this particular assignment? And then in your own voice, speak out those things in topic sentences or paragraphs with maybe an introduction, some brief topic sentences, and then conclusions. And then you can also figure out some of the things that you want to support those facts. But then also, if you want to have AI do a comparison, you can take a look at it and see what suggestions that it has. And I call that more assistive technology rather than letting it just do all the work for you.
Right.
And then being able to look at both and analyze them. And I always find, wow, this thing from AI was total garbage in some cases. I might get some ideas from it though. And that's the point, is being able to interject those ideas back into it. What things do you see as the teacher facilitator, doctor of the program, that really help you on the teaching side using AI, whether it's assessing work or building course material or getting ideas? What do you think helps in that side?
I think getting ideas is probably the quickest thing that will be useful. If you think about it, what right now is whatever the tools out there, right? It is a pretty good average, because what is sent on the internet and the data being put out there and they're being used to train the model, it's a pretty good average. But is it the best? No, I think anyone who have the skill sets and right knowledge can easily beat it. But it's going to take quite a few years to get there, to beat the average. So I think you could definitely use it to help you facilitate in terms of your learning. But if all you do is use it to generate answer and submit it once, really doesn't learn anything from that process. Those are what I call shortcuts. In some way, it's similar to the olden day, is cheating is happening. So the question is, my joke about it is, just don't get caught. If you want to cheat, how good are you about knowing how to cheat? Cheating, it has always been there. But this tool just made it so much easier. So I really believe that, and helping you learn and some of the things that you think that you know, and it could potentially spit out something that you do not know, but you cannot take it at face value. You got to research it. You got to go look into it. Is it really true, or should I take that into consideration? Let's, for example, if you enroll in a first cybersecurity class, and if your job is to write an overall cybersecurity plan for a mock-up company given to you, and if you didn't go learn the process throughout a session or throughout a semester, and you just had that tools generate a plan for you, you will never know how that plan become what it is. It's because you can go get a template. There's a reason for every single line that is in it. And it go back to our experience. When we do something in a certain way, it's because previous experience bit us in the behind that we have to do things in a certain way in order to get out of trouble. So within the first week, if you spit out a plan using a tool, you didn't learn it, are you able to go through the implement process in the future? Because ultimately, it is only the piece of information in front of you. Ultimately, you have to make it as a realization in the real world. It's all working with people, because cybersecurity in the real world is people, process, and technology. I think metrics should be in it too, because it's important. But people, process, and technology, you could have the information, you could have technology. If you don't know how to work with people, or get people to do what needs to get done, it will never be secure, because people, whether it's outsider threat or insider threat, are the biggest problem within cybersecurity environment.
If you were hiring a cybersecurity individual, what would be the most important factors for that person?
Actually, that might be a question for Eric instead of me, because I don't live in the real world.
Oh, wow. Loaded question. Really, from hiring people as a CISO and hiring and promoting people up through organizations and really asking them what they want to do and knowing what they're good at and what they like, they usually gravitate towards that. And if you don't give them that opportunity, they're going to go somewhere else and do it. They're going to get their cybersecurity experience at that firm and then go somewhere else. And so that's what I found, building teams from a couple people up to 10, 20, 30 or so. That's really been the most effective. And what you're doing then also, and you don't realize it, because you get somebody in there, maybe they're a security operations center analyst. They learn security beyond what they've been trained. They learn the real world things that happen, incident management, and all that. Then maybe they want to be an application security expert or a threat hunter or something like that. And so then they start getting that learning and knowledge from other older mentors that have been there for a while, or from course material or whatever it might be. And then they're able to go to that, and they're able to train and backfill their replacement. And so really what I look for are people who are eager to learn, eager to understand the business and learn the business, and our part in that, aligning with business objectives and cybersecurity objectives that support those business objectives, and their part in that. And a lot of these people I found that help us with things like audits. Hey, we really need help on this audit. We see that this is a risk, and we want to not only pass an audit, we want to be able to show that this is the reason we did something, and to be able to get the evidence for that. And so a lot of those people that helped us through those periods of time, I was able to place them into security roles, and they would thrive in that because they were showing that they were willing to help the business and be that piece of cybersecurity that supported the overall business objectives.
Yeah. Thank you, Eric and Maurice. Eric, I just thought that you're a better person to answer that question than anything else. I do want to add, in higher ed, when I hire more for attitude than anything else. Mm-hmm. The right sets of attitude, and I will always find out what their interest in learning. Because here's what I think. Attitude, to me, is the most important thing. Having some basic knowledge is key, right? But after that, one, if somebody have the right attitude, whatever you give it to them, or whatever that needs to get done, you can go learn, you can go talk to people, you can go figure out what needs to get done. And the truth is, when we, after 20 some odd year in higher ed, I know one thing is, you will never get it right the first time. And especially when we teach a class, by the time you do it a third time, you're getting it almost right. And by that point in time, you probably want to change everything. So to me, in addition to all the things that Eric said, which is not what I, in higher ed, not what we worry about, especially on the education and teaching side, I needed the person to have the right attitude. In real world cybersecurity, what you all are in, especially in Eric's world, is it's a pressurized environment. But for us, it's a different type of pressure and different type of stress. And if you look at my eyes, a little bloodshot, and a couple of days ago, it's even worse. And my joint hurts, my jaw hurts. And at some point in time, stress is going to get to you, because someday you can control it, and how you deal with it mentally versus physically is all different. So the question is, ones need to learn how to let go too. And the pressure cooker is a real thing.
Great points.
The word that kept on coming up, especially with you, is resilience. And I'm going to pivot to something else. You work with a number of different companies and educators. How would you define, but also how would you measure resilience, especially in a corporation or academic setting?
I learned this probably about 4 to 6 years ago. I forgot now, because how we build a program, I'll tell you, this is completely crazy. There's always a lot of problem with it, but you have to fine tweak it. So I joke about it. Two things: when shit hits the fan, that's when I shine. And the other thing is, you always need to continue to make adjustments. You got to be ready for it. So yeah. The truth is, I'm pretty close and don't want to do it anymore, because it gets really hard. Because fundamentally, I'm a researcher or an educator in my way. I have a probably pretty high level of ADHD or ADD or whatever, all three acronym and four acronym. I probably got some of those, because in my old world, which I still live in it, is that I have every 4 to 6 months, I have a new group of students. In a way, I get to reset my environment. Or every 3 years, 1 to 3 years or 5 years, whatever, I have a project funded. I get to reset things that I do or do different things. Also, the way we built this program, instead of hire a bunch of full-time cyber people, which we can afford to begin with, is I did the next best thing. I hired a professional as adjunct, which is completely crazy, but I have to have a team of people and also help to manage that environment. So in a way, there is some resiliency built into it, but people, when they talk about resiliency, they actually mean robustness. Okay, the ability to withstand some stress when something being pushed, how well that system or organization withstand the stress. But I learned about resiliency not from the marketing, because in the real world, when people or a company or anyone talk about resiliency, that's basically what they mean, robustness. I learned it from someone I met at INL, but left INL and went back to East Coast and introduced me to a paper called 4R concept. The 4R, the four words means. So robustness, redundancy, resourcefulness, and rapidity. So those four words, I believe, truly define what resiliency is without using the word resilient. Okay. Yeah. It is, because if you have resources, it measure how quickly can you get to it. It also measure how much resources you have, and how quickly can you get to it? And within the resources that you have, is there any redundancy? But in cybersecurity, you got to be careful with redundancy, because redundancy, same redundancy, same hardware, same software could have the same vulnerability. And So that's how I look at it. But in terms of building a system or an organization to support anything, or for me is an education program, is there is always resilient issue, is because how do I have somebody come behind me and able to pick up what I do? So for a while, I was thinking I can find one person replace what I do. This is not ego talking.
Yeah.
I'm not talking ego, big ego, but everybody have a little bit of that, right? I say like, I should be able to find one person to replace what I do for this program. I struggled with it for a couple of years, okay? I wasn't able to find anyone. And ultimately, I come to a decision that I actually need two or three people to help with different part of it, so that the program office in itself will be more resilient, because two or three people has awareness of what each other are doing, can help each other out. It's another thing that I joke about. I hope if I don't get run over by a truck, because then we got a problem. But right now, it's going to take a bit of time to get there, where you build a program office where it's more resilient. If there's something goes wrong with it, the whole thing doesn't completely go to hell. There's still a way to make adjustment. But the cool thing is, if an adjunct or instructor will say that, hey, this is probably the last time I want to teach this, that's okay. Because when you run an asynchronous online program, our students are in 35 or 40 states, right? My instructor are everywhere too. When the whole North America is your recruiting ground for your instructor, you make your life a lot easier. If you know me a little bit more, I probably don't know how to shut up at times, but it really takes a lot of backbone to tell student or instructor what they need to hear instead of what they want to hear. But sometimes I hold back too. I don't tell the whole truth anymore, because most people cannot take the whole truth.
That's a great example, Dr. Liu, of being able to build a resilient program, because you've got that kind of succession planning. You've got multiple people. It's almost like business continuity in a business,
yep,
where you've
yep,
got
exactly.
multiple people and a
yep.
little bit of overlaps, and you've got system overlaps for kind of disaster recovery. So that's awesome.
Yep.
A while ago, you talked about critical infrastructure. You talked about INL, Idaho National Labs, which is nuclear. With critical infrastructure, and maybe threats like attackers using AI more effectively, or whatever methods that they are using, what are your thoughts on training new cybersecurity people or existing cybersecurity people to understand how to protect critical infrastructure, and changing things over the last couple years in order to make them most successful on defending it?
I think two things. One thing is, when you design critical infrastructure, you really got to involve cybersecurity thinking process as part of the engineering process. So there's a good framework on that, but it's very difficult to get engineering program to think differently or add to it. So that's one thing. But the thing that I think that's one thing is, got to design it correctly to begin with, because I believe 80% of our critical infrastructure in the private sector, and a private sector is maximizing revenue. So that's one thing, is design it the right way. The second thing is probably a combination of, you really have to assessing what is your crown jewel and what can fail. And then part of the second thing is, part B is the people, and which I'm probably more passionate about on that. This is another thing I joke about. Sometimes people, hopefully they don't take me too seriously. Even I have a 17-year-old, and a few years ago before pandemic, he basically grown up here at university. I make my round talking to my guys and student, and came back to office. He's, you don't even do anything anymore. All you do is talk to people. I said, that's what I do now. So I'm really interested in educating those students that know how to do the basic, because cybersecurity is so broken. I think partially is people that are in it. And also, we are not just paying attention to basic, but doing the really basic stuff is really difficult. It's because in some ways, it's really boring. And I've seen why. So I go everywhere in terms of my conversation. It is the reason why you really got to know how to evaluate what is important to you, is because then you can put layer of defense around it. Maybe after the evaluation, saying that it is so darn important that we really should not be connecting to this, to the internet, and get it disconnected. But you still have information security problem. You don't have cybersecurity problem, but you still have information security problem. You got to pay attention to that too. So you got to do that evaluation. In order to do that evaluation, it takes time. It doesn't have to be expensive, but you're going to have to train a bunch of people that is capable of doing that. It doesn't mean that you need every single one of them to be at the top notch of your program or top 10% or top 1% or 5%. You just need a lot of people that can do risk assessment and risk management and knowing how to put the control in place. My biggest worry is the rural community, the small water district, and a lot of critical infrastructure that is in the hand of the small city, a small county that don't have resources to do anything. That's why I probably spend a lot of thought and thinking about how can those rural entities not keep having have to bring in contractor to do the work. But the problem, I'm saying the contractor, there's a good use for it to help you get going. But at some point in time, you going to need to build resiliency in your talent pipeline. So the question is, how can we train people that already living in that community to do that work for them? So critical infrastructure, it's a huge one, is because the modern society can live on without it. So how do we have all those people protecting it? It's a really tough one. And I've been working with INL quite a bit on that, because INL support me in multiple way and through joint appointment. So I get a badge and I get access to it. Instead of submitting an agenda to go have a meeting, I can go find people right in the building if I need to. those are helpful. But at the same, and so they support me on that. But also as part of it, they want me to go out there and train and look at what we can do, training and educating people. And they could be going to private sector, but the cool thing is some of them probably going to be working in some of those critical infrastructure companies. And guess what? The best place to be or needed to be is might as well be educated in K-12 or in the college, because when I designed the program, probably still a little too idealistic till now or before that too, is I give an opportunity to students to go get a taste of what teaching is about as part of the graduate program. And just 1 credit hour, I just want to get you a taste of it and count the work that you do for that teaching as 1 credit hour. And as usual, some students really like it. Some will say, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm sorry, Eric, I've probably gone everywhere.
Oh, that's perfect. That's perfect. I especially like what you said, too, about allowing the graduate students to be able to teach. When I was at HP, I did that at night. I was an adjunct professor for one of the local colleges. And it really is interesting, because you can also learn from the students as well. So I found it very educational for myself. And so that's probably what the graduate students see as well. But some of the things you said also on the critical infrastructure are super interesting, and especially having some of the people that are a part of the business being invested into that, rather than having some private contractors just come in and build something. And then back in the old days, like 25, 20 years ago, we would say, if it compiles, ship it. And really designing security from the beginning wasn't really a thought, but having secure architecture from the beginning in the security pipeline, integrating the processes into DevOps, software engineering from the start is extremely important. And also, I'd like to know your thoughts about this, maybe risk assessment on existing critical infrastructure systems. That could possibly be an opportunity to say, has this been done this way? Is there an opportunity for a re-architecture and redesign and build a completely different system to the side of it and then migrate over? Is that something that possibly some of these maybe local water systems or other really critical infrastructure companies should be looking at?
Yeah, I think so. But they definitely need to think about it. I think sometimes it may not be a full risk assessment. It is probably just a quick vulnerability assessment to just understanding whether what kind of vulnerability that exists in the network, in the system. And more importantly, is if you say we have a security operations center, when we do a scan, did the security operations center actually see it? Most cases, and you guys probably know this better than I do, they probably bought the tools and bought the technology, but they didn't get configured correctly, which is tough. That's why I say education is important, is that you got to give them the big picture. Implementing what a cybersecurity program is all about. They know different phases of it. And guess what? It's so much more easier once you understand what needs to get done. And it's so much easier to go find the tools. At some point in time, when you have to go spend money, at least you know what to spend money on. What I'm really passionate about right now is a lot of school wanted to do the CTE, career technical education, in high school. And I probably will be getting a small grant from one of the state agencies is, I'm just going to help the rural school, high school, to train their teacher, get them the CTA endorsement so they can do it, because there are only two or three or four high school within state of Idaho that has the ability to do that now. I think we need to do more. But I'm also really mindful is, if you take a group of students and if you steer more towards one direction, guess what? We need more nurses, we need more engineers, we also need more doctors too. And so I'm really mindful when I go talk about it, is you got to understand your interest too. If you really wanted to go in depth, you can still be a cyber person, but sometimes engineering background, again, I have bias because I have electrical and computer engineering background. That's what my bachelor, master, and PhD are in, that is because having a technical background and understand the fundamental of why things it is the way it is and how system get built, and then how we can inject cybersecurity as part of the design process, I believe future system can be safer, because you have done that analysis that if this go to hell, somebody got in, and then there is still a way for this to survive. AI can do that. Maybe it will, maybe it can already, the ChatGPT 4.5 or 5.0 or something like that. But we got to train people. So the question is, will the new generation still as excited about learning or going forward? I'm worried about it.
That's very valid, because, I mean, think about when we were all young, we went through college, we learned the fundamentals. We had to learn these very difficult programming languages back in the day. And when we see what's available now, we think, are people going to take the easier path? Or are they going to learn the fundamentals to understand how those systems operate in the first place, so that they can be able to fix problems? And maybe not all of those assistive tools will be there for them to be able to help. Maybe there will be some disconnect of being able to actually get onto those systems to help. And if they don't have the fundamentals, it's going to be a big problem to understand how the system really works in the first place.
Yeah. And it's another thing that I go back to, it is knowing what you know, knowing what you don't know, and also not knowing what you don't know, which is the tough one. I joke about it. There's so much that I don't know. Sometimes I do not know what I don't know. But the thing is, once you realize what you don't know, you can do something about it. And guess what? What you don't know, when you keep researching and reading and looking into it, you're going to find out the don't know, and don't know hopefully will become less and less. But the thing is, at that point in time, ego might take over too. I say, I know everything. I joke about it with my wife and kids. I say, yeah, I know that. I know everything. But the thing is, just, I was just trying to be funny, but sometimes people take me a little too seriously. It's difficult. Sometimes in academia, there's a food chain too. I'm in a comfortable position, but my problem is I'm my own worst enemy. When I have an idea, I know where to get the money, go find the money to do the work. I just create more work for myself. So let me describe to you the three. I'm still in electrical and computer engineering department, and I run a side gig called Cyber Operation and Resilience Program. And I also have work that I do with INL. And also, I always come up with idea, and how can I go find money? How can I go find money to show a different state agency how we can help them build their own cybersecurity talent pipeline? I say that, I don't want you, let's not worry about how you can lose people. Let's say, but how can you have a talent pipeline coming behind those to fill those positions when you need it? Because there's still a really weird thing, Eric probably knows this much better than I do, is there's still a really weird environment where the cybersecurity hiring practices is still really messed up. The job description and what they're looking for and what they're willing to pay for is completely out of whack. Then we have a group of students that thinking that there's millions and hundreds of thousands of jobs out there, which from a Department of Labor report, which is completely not true. I think there's a kernel of truth to it, but you have to take a discount. So those students need experience, and this group of people, then there are a lot of organizations out there that really needed the help. So how do we pay them up and show them how they can build a program? So I'm working with a couple of state agencies to show them how they can do that. I even put my own money into it too. And once I put my own money into it to show them how they can do it, they can put it in the budget, and I can continue to fund money to fund it, that opportunity. Because ultimately, a lot of students need the opportunity to get them in. And sometimes the opportunity may not be easily opened up. And then now this is even better. And then there will be different because people had known me for quite a few years. Now they'll come back to me. Hey, we're looking for a person in this area. And do you have student in this area? I can have someone to run a list for me. And then within 50 miles in that area, I have 50 students. It's about the position that I can help create an opportunity for a lot of students. And I'm excited about it. But at the same time, I'm scared too, because it could be too much responsibility. That's probably what stress did to me.
I absolutely love your passion. Obviously, you care about the students and the discipline itself.
Maurice.
Yeah.
Eric too. Maybe someday or most day I'm full of shit too.
You never know. You pick a good day and yeah. And actually, Maurice, I think that Dr. Liu is solving a lot of the problems that we've had on, think of the first podcast that we did. There are people out there who it's just connecting A to B. Some really good cybersecurity professionals who they've went this path that was very good. And now they're wondering what to do. And so really that just like Dr. Liu said, the hiring process is really wacky. It's completely crazy for cybersecurity professionals. And I think there's a big disconnect. There are some firms that are doing it very well. And they understand cybersecurity. They understand the business. They understand the talent that should be in those type of positions. But then there's always like job postings and you'll get 99% of unqualified people for a particular role, which good for them for at least applying. But then it makes it harder for the HR generalist or whoever is looking at it to be able to understand and filter through this and find a good qualified candidate. Therefore, most good cybersecurity positions aren't even listed. They're through networks and understanding, reaching out to networks and saying, hey, look, there's a person that's looking for this, or hey, I need to hire for this. And then pulling through those networks, because really it's totally wacky, the hiring process for cybersecurity people.
And partially, it's probably the people that are in it too. They are looking for people that exactly like them. And it doesn't exist because it takes them 20, 30 years to get that weird skill set. And you can find, and then they will be saying, we're going to post an entry-level position and it still exists out there. We have some certification requirement that somebody probably have to have a 3 to 5 years in order to get it. I say, you can do that. Or you post an entry-level position and you interview, you reject someone. Could be, I've seen some really good candidate got rejected because they told them, they were being told that they don't have enough experience, but it's an entry-level position. What is this about? You can do that. I don't know. Is someday, I joke about it too. I'm probably serious, not joking anymore. I'm probably full of shit too. Is because how are we going to fix that? Actually, there's another bigger thing. The cybersecurity in the insurance industry, and I was at an event a couple of weeks ago, the insurance cybersecurity industry is all their business model, whether they're for profit or non-profit, right? It is about minimizing the payout. They're not fixing the problem. I'm sorry to say it. This is part of the problem. Somebody might come after me now. So the cybersecurity industry really isn't part of the solution. They are minimizing the payout. Say, we're going to bring it back, bring you back to what you were. But ultimately, you're going to have to fix the problem, how somebody got in it. The bigger the organization, the bigger the network, the bigger the system, the larger the attack surface, the more problem they're going to have. So doing the basic right is really complicated. So how can we also get the cybersecurity insurance industry to come along to look at things differently? If you really help people to do things differently, there's a potential that, I think there's high potential that you can minimize the payout too. You only know how good your insurance is when you need to use it. So when I heard about it at that event and how that insurance person behaved, I say, oh man, that's why things are so broken.
I'm glad to hear this, Dr. Liu. I have negotiated cybersecurity insurance for companies. And yes, there's a lot of things in the contracts that they just don't pay for. Yep. So if business leaders are thinking, oh, we'll just buy cyber insurance and that will cover us, that is a very wrong idea. And also the cyber insurance companies, they won't cover you unless you can pass minimum standards. And so therefore, you should just do it right the first time. And again, it's risk-based, showing what type of industry you're in, the controls that you're doing based on that, that you're protecting your customers, protecting intellectual property, customer data, employee data, and all of that. So it's the cybersecurity insurance business, I think some are doing it right. They're doing a lot of that analysis, but yet every year they cover less and less, and certain scenarios they don't cover. And so looking at those policies is very interesting.
Maybe this is something for you too, or we three can do something. I joke about it with someone else too. Maybe we should start a new cybersecurity company where we concentrate on the right thing to help people to do the right thing, still protect them. The thing is fundamental. You don't do cybersecurity based on checklists. You really got to do real cybersecurity to do it right. People, process, and technology, and having the right metrics to make sure you really do the right thing.
I have a feeling we're going to have a lot of discussions in the future.
Then they say, you do the right thing. Trust me, there's still something bad could still happen. And when shit hits the fan, that's when coverage kicked in. The way that I learned the cybersecurity insurance industry works is if you don't call them right away, they're probably not going to cover you. And guess what? When you call them right, you have no control over anything anymore because their coach is going to come in, take over everything. You got no control over stuff. Yeah, so isn't that part of the problem? If we wanted to put you, I buy, you are my insurance carrier. I think we together should be looking at it together. How can we solve this problem instead of I lose complete control and you take over everything? And because you have an objective of minimizing payout, whatever you find, you say that you can decline, you can use it to decline the claim. So yeah, that's another broken thing. I was so awakened by that moment. I was like, oh, that's another thing. That's why it's so broken. I'm not sure how to fix it. Unless somebody out there with a big pocket or really crazy enough to want to go start something new to do it the right way. Who knows?
It needs to be more collaborative between industries, because that's really how it works, is having a breach retainer service. But then when that happens, when the big thing hits the fan, and then it all goes through your legal teams at that point, you just say, here's what happened. We notify, we follow these procedures that we've set. We've done maybe tabletops or rehearsals on this. And then it's really them with the boots on the ground with that expertise during a breach that takes over. Like you said, they take over. Yeah. And so really, if we have a more collaborative approach, I think that's going to be better for the company. It's going to be better for also the insurance company, because then there's more vested interest by the people that are owning and operating that company.
Yep.
This has been a fantastic discussion. We need to have another discussion if you'd be willing.
No problem. Yeah. I joke about it. I'm not doing anything around here.
You don't think you're doing much, but really your advice helps a lot of other people.
It does.
It's through all of these years of experience. So that's good. Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Liu. That's very good.
You just got to keep learning. There's so much free stuff out there, but ultimately in a modern society, up to a certain point in time, you're going to need the education. We're here to help.